I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Ike is moving through the Gulf of Mexico, heading toward Texas, and the storm has prompted an unusual warning from the National Weather Service. It says residents of Galveston, Texas, face certain death if they don't evacuate. Galveston officials issued mandatory evacuation orders, and Ike could be the largest hurricane to hit Texas in decades. Paul Pendergraft is senior producer for news and public affairs at the Houston public radio station KUHF. And Paul, Ike is a Category 2 storm, but forecasters say it could strengthen before it makes landfall either tonight or early tomorrow. Can you describe what the situation is like right now in Houston?
Well, right now in Houston, there's a great sense of anticipation. I don't want to call it panic, but there's a heightened sense of we're about to deal with something very serious. And we know that our friends 50 miles down the coast in Galveston are really facing trouble. They're already, as we're seeing on some video, the 17-foot storm wall at Galveston is already seeing waves that are topping it. Hmm. And the storm surge hasn't even arrived. So there's a very good chance that Galveston Island will be inundated with water, and it is a barrier island, and it may be completely covered with water. And there's most of the island has evacuated, but there are still some souls that remain on the island.
Hmm. And what are residents of Houston being told? Are there any evacuation orders in Houston?
There are some little communities along the waterway, and those areas have been evacuated, and they're at risk of flooding. But most of the evacuation took place yesterday and the day before, and it was remarkably organized by comparison to the nightmare we had 3 years ago with Rita. You have to remember that Rita occurred 3 weeks after Katrina, so there was a heightened sense of anxiety. So a lot of people tried to evacuate that didn't really need to. So a lot of people who evacuated last time didn't this time, and that helped.
And so steps have been taken to make sure that only the people who really need to evacuate are getting out of the way.
It's been handled much more in an orderly fashion, and the constituents, the folks that are at risk, are really taking this seriously. I have to give them credit. Now, there are a few knuckleheads that have decided to stick it out where they shouldn't, and they very well may pay a high price. I just heard a report a few minutes ago from a community down on the coast called Surfside, and people are staying there that are clearly going to be flooded, and police went out this morning and were gathering names and social security numbers, and there's only one reason why they'd do that, hoping to identify the bodies after the storm.
Right now, Ike is a Category 2 storm,
right,
as we said, but it's huge, isn't it?
It's monstrous. It's unbelievably big. It's larger than Katrina was, but it's acting like a much larger storm. There are studies that have been done from some of our meteorologists, and it's actually moving more water with a storm surge than Katrina did, despite the fact that it's not as strong wind-wise as Katrina was. So this is going to be a double hitter for the coast of Texas. There's going to be a serious storm surge in excess of 16 feet, and then there's going to be Category 2 winds, so we're a little bit nervous today. We've done the best we can, and we're just hopeful that we can assess the damage in the next day or so and make the best of it.
Landfall tonight is what we're hearing.
Yeah, one of the cruelties of the weather is that sometimes these visits come in the middle of the night, and darkness makes the sounds and the fury that much worse. Our imaginations take us to a place sometimes that are pretty bad. In this case, I think the reality will match that.
And what will you be doing, Paul?
I'll be at the station. I'm heading in about an hour, and we will be on the air as long as we can be. We've got reporters out in the field trying to be as safe with them as we can be, but obviously we need to get them out there where the story is, and they'll be reporting for us tonight and tomorrow and for as long as it takes. I mean, and this is kind of one of those difficult times for our industry, as you know, because we're affected by it too. I've had to board up my home, and when I leave it, I live in Houston, so I don't suspect the house will be gone, but who knows how much damage there will be to the area and down trees, and we'll be out of electricity for a while. So there's a real challenge for reporters during a time like this, like there are other folks. We have to do our jobs and continue with our lives as best we can.
All right. Well, good luck, Paul.
Thank you.
Paul Pendergraft is senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF in Houston. And some other news about Hurricane Ike. The storm has stranded 22 people on board a 584-foot freighter ship that broke down in the Gulf of Mexico. It's right in the path of Hurricane Ike. And the Coast Guard says those people are going to have to wait it out because it's too dangerous right now for a rescue attempt. Well, Hurricane Ike's pending assault on the Gulf Coast has some economic ramifications as well. The storm has prompted several major oil refineries in that area to either shut down or curtail production. And that is increasing concerns that pump prices could go even higher. Meanwhile, the stock price for the investment bank Lehman Brothers is headed in the other direction, and the for sale sign is out. Lehman's shares are plummeting after the company reported losses of almost $7 billion in the last two quarters alone, and those are its biggest losses ever. Reports say some sort of buyout deal could be announced over the weekend before the Asian markets open on Monday. And according to the Associated Press today, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is against any use of government money in whatever deal that might come together for Lehman. Well, Joe Nocera is a business columnist for the New York Times. His most recent book is Good Guys and Bad Guys, Behind the Scenes with the Saints and Scoundrels of American Business and Everything in Between. He's here in Boston today, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Lehman Brothers first and
sure.
The news of what's going on there, that the federal government just came off the heels of bailing out mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and then we hear that Lehman Brothers has a lot of troubles. Is this unprecedented? You've been covering business for a long time, and how would you describe the climate right now?
Well, it's unprecedented in my lifetime. That doesn't mean it's unprecedented. I mean, we did have this thing called the Great Depression, which fortunately I was not alive for. But yes, it's unprecedented in the cascading effect that has taken place. That's really what one of the things that feels different this time. Previously, you had one-offs, the Asian-Russian crisis, which was serious, very serious, but it only really brought down one firm, Long-Term Capital Management, which had made a bunch of mistakes, and everyone in Washington and on Wall Street kind of rallied around to make sure that Long-Term Capital Management's failure didn't affect the system. So this time, and Lehman Brothers is a good example of this, there really aren't that many private companies left who can rally around to protect the system because they're all hurting so badly. So, Bear Stearns, the government wants to save them because they're afraid of the effect it'll have on the financial markets. And so J.P. Morgan gets them for a song. Mm-hmm. I mean, really a song. Then you have Freddie taken over by the government, worried about the same thing. And now you have Lehman Brothers. And they're talking about a Lehman Brothers deal. But when you look at the landscape, you have to wonder who's left to buy them.
Right, right. Well, obviously the reports are possibly Bank of America or Barclays. Could we see another deal where maybe Lehman Brothers will go for a song to somebody?
They certainly will. First of all, they will go for a song. Number one, I mean, their stock price is down this year alone over 90%. It's a $4 stock. Billions and billions have already been lost. But who cares about that? I mean, the real issue is, should one of these banks be allowed to fail? Should the government be coming in and guaranteeing this stuff, their bad loans, to salvage them? Or should these guys have to basically take their medicine and fold? Just as, by the way, many homeowners have to do when they get foreclosed on.
Right. So do you think the government will step in the case of Lehman Brothers and help? I mean, there are reports, right, that there's some sort of talk going on with the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department with potential buyers for
right.
Lehman Brothers.
Right. It's really hard to know. I mean, I think this is going to play out very quickly. We'll almost surely know what's going to happen by Monday. I'm sure the government right now, Hank Paulson at the Treasury Department and Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, are twisting arms trying to get somebody to buy them, and they will ultimately, undoubtedly, offer to basically take really bad loans off their books or guarantee them or somehow sort of paper them over. But ultimately, the government can't force somebody to do this, and the big fear is then what happens then?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Now, how, I guess the question is, how did it get to this point, and why didn't anyone heed the warnings? You've pointed out that former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan warned about Fannie and Freddie Mac repeatedly. How did things get to this level so quickly, this cascading that you're talking about, right. Do you think?
In every bull market, things get carried to excess. So you had the internet bull market. It's really easy to see with the internet bubble because you could see all these companies that had no profits but had $200 stock prices. That bubble burst. Those prices went down. They went up because everybody was euphoric about internet companies and they couldn't help themselves and they just bought, and then finally it just collapsed of its own weight. The housing crisis is actually far more serious than that, but it is part and parcel of the same mentality. Housing prices were going up, and then they started going up faster. And then people said, okay, I'm going to get a home equity loan. And then they thought, you know, I'll get even more, bigger home equity loan. And then I'll flip my house and get a new house. And, you know, I can't lose. And I'll get a no down payment loan and a subprime loan and an alternate A loan. And everybody in the system just completely got carried away and forgot that there were consequences for making these loans to people who couldn't pay them back. The whole system was rigged in such a way that everybody got fees, and so their goal was to make the loan up front, get the fee, pass the loan on to somebody else, and ultimately it wound up on Wall Street in the form of a securitized mortgage. So it's not just the homeowners, it's not just the mortgage lenders, it's not just the brokers, it's not just the banks who made the loan. This affected everybody in America, the entire system from top to bottom. If you ever wonder whether Wall Street affects Main Street and Main Street affects Wall Street, this is it. The interconnection is astounding. So when it did turn out that the economy started to turn and, by God, people had to start paying back these loans and they couldn't pay them back, the same cascade, it started cascading. It's as if the dominoes started to fall from the homeowner to the mortgage lender, to the broker, to the bank, to Wall Street. And that's basically what happened. And our economy hasn't turned around. It's not going to anytime soon. And this has a giant depressing effect on every factor of the economy. And these Wall Street firms had loaded up on these mortgage bank securities and thought they were cheap and easy way to make money and riskless have discovered, horror, when you take riskier bets, you have a bigger chance of failure.
Right. And a lot of greed, it sounds like, involved here on some different levels.
You know, I don't mean to be snarky, but yes, it's a lot of greed. But in good times or bad times, a talk show host in Boston is going to say there's a lot of greed. And there's no more or less greed with this than any other aspect of American financial life. Sometimes it works out well when Bill Gates' greed builds Microsoft. Sometimes it works out poorly when idiots buy mortgage-backed securities thinking they're going to get rich.
So it's just human nature, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's the downside of human nature. It is a psychology that is part and parcel of all of us, not just Wall Street gurus.
Joe Nocera is business columnist for The New York Times. Our conversation continues after a break. And later in the show, the 10 worst ideas from the presidential candidates. It's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. And we're back with New York Times business columnist Joe Nocera. We're talking about the problems with Lehman Brothers and the federal bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And Joe, you said earlier there are not many companies out there that can afford to buy Lehman Brothers, and the federal government may end up stepping in. And now we're reading reports about trouble at Washington Mutual. Where do you think all of this is headed?
It's impossible to know where it's going to end. It's almost as if the spotlight changes from firm to firm as one goes down. The spotlight is, you know, Bear Stearns went down, spotlight went to Fannie Freddie. Fannie Freddie goes down, spotlight's on Lehman. Lehman's going down soon. Spotlight will soon be on WaMu and Merrill Lynch, which is also having lots of problems. And it's almost as if once a firm gets in the spotlight, it is paralyzed and can't raise capital. And I mean, Lehman's big problem is that it waited too long to raise capital. And at the point at which the spotlight was on it, nobody wanted to give it capital, and now it doesn't have enough capital. That's really its fundamental core problem at this moment. So it's hard to know where it will end. And that's really, really scary.
Are there, would you say, connections between what's happening to Lehman and Fannie and Freddie? And could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, sure. I mean, it is of a piece. They both held giant portfolio, large, well, Fannie and Freddie's is much bigger, but they held portfolios of mortgage-backed securities that have gone sour. And they've had to do write-downs. I mean, it's the same financial instruments is bringing all these firms down. That's what brought Bear Stearns down. It's all about, you know, securitized mortgages, mortgage derivatives, so-called credit swaps, which are also based around mortgages. This is all about mortgages. Mm-hmm. The difference is that Fannie and Freddie's portfolio of mortgages, by the way, which they didn't have to do under their government mandate, they did it because they were greedy. is in the trillions as opposed to the billions. And it's Fannie and Freddie is a much scarier prospect, because if Fannie and Freddie were to go under, not only would you have trillions of dollars worth of derivatives that essentially blew up, but the housing market would be completely paralyzed, because the FHA and Fannie and Freddie right now are the only companies in America, the only people in America who are guaranteeing mortgages. And if you don't have that, you don't have a mortgage market.
Right.
So saving them had a slightly different rationale than saving these other places, because if the one thing the country can't afford now, it's a paralyzed housing market. You have to have people buying and selling houses.
And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as you've pointed out in some of your columns, are also very different because of the mission.
Well, you know, now you're going to get me on a rant.
That's okay.
Because the mission is affordable housing, allegedly. But basically, they have used that mission as their excuse, as their fig leaf, to run roughshod over all their opponents. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Barney Frank. I admire him in a million ways. But I think this is his blind spot. He really cares about affordable housing. And he will not brook criticism of Fannie and Freddie. And he and Chris Dodd and many, many other Democrats have just put their bodies on the track and said, you know, you will not mess with Fannie and Freddie. And this is one thing. Alan Greenspan was wrong about a lot of things, but he was right about Fannie and Freddie. He was saying for years, openly and not with his usual mumbo jumbo, that Fannie and Freddie posed a danger to the system because their portfolios were too big. And nobody listened.
Because?
Because Fannie and Freddie had enormous political power, because they had lending operations. They had operations in all these key congressional districts. They knew how to play the game, and they played it brilliantly. And the people who ran Fannie and Freddie, like Jimmy Johnson and Franklin Raines, were masterful politicians, and because they had the quote-unquote mission. So even though the mortgage portfolio stuff that they did has nothing to do with their mission whatsoever, nothing, they were untouchable. And the building of the portfolio had to do with their stock price and growth and feeding the investor community and, by the way, lining their own pockets, because they all had tons and tons of options. But you can't say that to Barney Frank, or he'll bite your head off. Which he does, by the way, brilliantly.
So that was very much a very different kind of situation. But overall, we haven't seen the end of it. Dire picture for the economy overall.
It's not a good situation. There's a lot of people who've lost their jobs in the airline industry, in the auto industry, and my God, Wall Street. I think I read somewhere today that 83,000 jobs have been lost on Wall Street alone this year. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And finally, Joe, you know, we spoke with you a while ago about the Harry Potter creator.
Ah, yes.
J.K. Rowling, who sued to prevent the publication of a Harry Potter lexicon that was a book edition of all things Harry that was run by a former school librarian. And you sided with the librarian.
Right.
But the ruling came down this week, and Rowling won.
Well, it's a very interesting ruling. I ranted that time, too, when I was here. I know that. But it's a very interesting ruling, because what the judge basically did was he affirmed the right of people like the librarian to write derivative works that are based on the work of someone else, which was the principle involved. But then he basically said the lexicon itself, the work, was he almost said it like it wasn't good enough to merit that protection. In other words, it didn't advance the ball enough. It didn't have enough of its own sort of thought and innovation to be afforded the fair use right. It's hard for you and I to judge that ourselves because the thing's not published and you can't see it. But, you know, it basically, in terms of the issues that I care about on this, I actually think the judge came down on, you know, my side, that fair use is appropriate and lifting the work of someone else in the furtherance of a set of new ideas or even an encyclopedia based on their work is fine. The judge just said, this guy, there's not enough originality here to merit the fair use argument.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to ranting with you again sometime soon.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
Jonah Serra, business columnist for The New York Times. His columns appear on Saturday. How's tomorrow's column looking? What's that going to be about?
It's going to be a column that Google won't like very much.
Okay.
So enjoy.
Looking forward to it. Thanks very much. Still ahead today, Patriots versus the Jets. Lance Armstrong says he's coming back to cycling and remembering a man who changed the game of college basketball. With only a game host, Bill Littlefield, it's Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. According to Foreign Policy magazine, John McCain's top 10 worst ideas include the gas tax holiday and allowing for more offshore oil drilling. That's interesting, since polls indicate that those are some of McCain's most popular plans. Foreign Policy magazine drew up the top 10 list of worst McCain ideas, and it did the same for Barack Obama. Among Obama's worst ideas, sitting down with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and opening up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Well, Blake Hounshell is web editor for Foreign Policy magazine, and he joins us from the Washington radio studio of its publisher, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Hi, Blake.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, well, we're having a little bit of fun with your list here, but these are serious issues. Can you tell me how the list came about and what were the guidelines for worst ideas of the presidential candidates?
We've been beating these around for a few weeks now in staff meetings. And what we wanted to look at were great policy ideas, whether they're popular or not, that experts look at and say, you know what, this is not the right way to go. So that was our main criterion. And we wanted to avoid fraught topics like social issues that, you know, people have hotly held views.
So you wanted to just sort of look at them from...
from a wonkish standpoint.
From a wonkish standpoint. But you did point out, for example, McCain's support for abstinence-only education and the ban on giving foreign aid to agencies that offer abortion counseling.
That's a fair point. And the reason we did that is because there was this landmark congressional study saying that, you know, this, there's no evidence that this works, that they reduce incidents of sexual intercourse among young people. So it seems like a very bad idea to start to make that the centerpiece of your AIDS policy.
Mm-hmm. You did talk about some of the proposals from both candidates for particular public policy questions. For example, gas prices. You said among McCain's worst ideas are his call for a gas tax holiday and, of course, drill baby drill and more offshore oil drilling. At the same time, you say some of Obama's worst ideas are his call to draw oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and impose a windfall profits tax on oil companies. Can you tell me how you came up with those?
Well, I think the overarching framework of the way we're thinking about this is that high gas prices are actually the only way we're going to get the United States off of its addiction to oil. The problem is not foreign oil, as people seem to think it is. The problem is oil. And the reason that, you know, people are driving less, people are buying smaller cars right now, people are taking the subway more, is because oil prices are where they are. And you can do things to offset, you know, the pain that that causes for American families. You can cut the payroll tax, for instance. And so all of these policies that both campaigns are proposing are a way to avoid the central problem. You know, they may be popular, like everyone loves the windfall profits tax. But ultimately, you're just kicking the can down the road.
Mm. And now you've been criticized for saying that that idea and a couple of the others are not good ones, haven't you? What's been the reaction?
Well, I did a radio show in Ohio earlier this week, and that's a place where people are definitely suffering economically, and nobody wants to hear some technocrat come and tell them that it's not a good idea to tax all these oil companies who are making record profits. And I certainly appreciate that. But I think what we need to do is move to a post-oil world.
Hmm. And why is the war in Iraq not on your list?
That's a very good question. And we definitely talked about it internally. And we were looking at kind of the consensus, the wonkish consensus, if you will. What technocrats are looking at and what they're saying about these ideas. And Iraq is something where you can have technocrats on either side making pretty strong arguments. One side will say, well, you don't want to set a timeline for withdrawal because that will embolden the enemy. And there's some evidence of that. And the other side says, well, look, the only reason that the surge worked is because there was talk about U.S. withdrawal, and that has changed the policy of Iraq. Mm. So that's one where we didn't feel comfortable weighing in on one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. What about bombing Pakistan? Obama did talk openly about bombing Pakistan. You say that's one of his worst ideas. But he also said that he would authorize a military incursion into Pakistan if he had credible information about where Osama bin Laden was. And now we're hearing that the U.S. is thinking about unilateral raids into Pakistan without Pakistan's permission. So what do you think of Obama's previous statements about Pakistan now? Has that changed?
Well, you know, he got hotly criticized at the time for proposing something that was, you know, some people were saying this was a radical idea, and when it was actually always U.S. policy to go into Pakistan if Musharraf, the Musharraf government at the time, wouldn't take action. And now we're hearing that there's this presidential order saying that U.S. troops are authorized to go into the border areas. That's probably a bad idea. We asked 5 Pakistani commentators to weigh in on that, and we have a piece on our website today called How to Catch Osama bin Laden. And all of them told us that this was the wrong way to go. The U.S. needs to think about the long-term approach, building friends and allies in the tribal areas. And going into Pakistan like this is only going to create wider opposition and put the Pakistani military in an uncomfortable political place.
Mm-hmm. Now, couldn't some of these things be maybe not solid proposals from the candidates, but sort of, you know, policy trial balloons, if you will, on the political campaign trail? You know, Obama's offering to meet with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He's since backed off on that a little bit to say that, you know, he didn't mean he was going to meet with him without preconditions and all of that. But wouldn't these sort of be just plans that are floated in the beginning stages of a political campaign?
Some of them definitely, yeah. And that's a good example. And that was something that was actually kind of a gaffe. You know, he was asked this offhand at this CNN YouTube debate, and he just said, sure, I'd do it. And he obviously hadn't thought it through. I don't think anyone's really worried that Barack Obama is actually just going to willy-nilly sit down with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But the point is that, you know, you need to think these things through.
Hmm. And so what do you do now? Do you come up with a best of list after worst of? Where do you go from here?
That's a good idea. We're definitely considering that. You'd find a lot more bipartisan kumbaya stuff than you would think, given the rhetoric on the campaign trail.
Do you already have an example of a best of?
Well, I think both of them would take a much more diplomatic approach to the world, a much more multilateral approach. John McCain has expressed support for the United Nations, where President Bush has tended to bash it. You know, Barack Obama is obviously very much of the multilateral mindset. Both of them have talked about getting smarter about taking a counterinsurgency approach to Afghanistan. So that's something that I think we'd like to see.
All right. Well, Blake, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Blake Hounchill is web editor for Foreign Policy Magazine. Coming up next week on Here and Now, from changing to a 4-day week or fundraisers to buy footballs for the high school football team, we look at how schools are coping with rising fuel costs and budget cuts. Also, the first world-class opera singer from China remembers his wild ride from Mao to the Met. That's next week. You're listening to Here and Now. This Sunday, the New England Patriots meet the New York Jets at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. It's one of the most intense rivalries in the National Football League, but how it might change after the season-ending injury of Patriots quarterback Tom Brady is unclear. Well, joining us to talk about that game and the rest of the news from the world of sports is Bill Littlefield. He's host of the show Only a Game. And Bill, nice to see you as always.
It's great to be here, Deb.
Okay, well, Patriots and Jets, long history, as we said. What are you looking at right
now?
Well,
of course, Bill Belichick was the assistant with the Jets from 97 to 99. He became head coach with the Jets in 99 and held that job for about 13 seconds and then resigned to become head coach of the Patriots, which caused some confusion and dismay, especially among Jets fans. And he did pretty well with the Patriots for a time.
Oh,
we'll see
bit.
How he does without his star quarterback. Jets had to got a draft pick from the Patriots for that crazy bunch of things that happened. I don't know. Belichick's great powers of magic will certainly be tested with the second string guy taking the snaps.
Right,
no question
right.
about that.
And how do you think, you know, not just the team, Bill, but what about the league without Tom Brady? He's really been a star for the Patriots and for the league itself.
Well, I came in prepared to talk about that, but I can't. It's too painful.
Do you think the game will be...
I think a lot of people will still watch football on Sunday afternoon and Monday night, but I think you're absolutely right that a sport like the NFL in the television age has only a limited number of stars and a limited number of people about whom you can say, that's the face of the game. And Tom Brady has certainly been one of those people, and so it was a real blow to the league when he went down, no question about it. It's like they used to say about Wayne Gretzky when he played in the National Hockey League. There's a 2-minute penalty for hitting anybody else and a 10-minute penalty for hitting Gretzky because nobody wanted him out of the game.
Right. So who will you be watching then in Sunday's game? Who are the folks to watch?
Well, it's very interesting, of course, to see what Brett Favre is going to do because he played his entire career, everybody thought, with the Green Bay Packers, and then very shortly after retiring, he decided that he didn't want to retire after all, and the Packers said, that's very interesting. We certainly don't want you to come back here because we've made alternative plans. And he ended up with the Jets, and he got elected captain of the Jets, which was, I thought, fascinating. There wasn't anybody who'd been there more than 20 minutes that they could have given the captaincy to, I guess. And he's upright and mobile and threw a couple of touchdowns last week, so it'll be very interesting to see what he does. And, of course, as I said, interesting to see what the Patriots are able to do with somebody else taking the snaps.
Right, right. Now, college football, big game tomorrow night, right? Number one ranked University of Southern California.
Absolutely. Coached by Pete Carroll, once coach of the Patriots. It all comes back.
It all does.
He was the guy that they fired so they could hire Bill Belichick back in 99. But he's done extraordinarily well as a college coach, of course. He's presided over two national champions. We'll see this year. They're ranked number one. We'll see if he can do it again.
Mm-hmm. And there was news from the cycling world this week. Lance Armstrong announced that he was returning after taking 3 years off. Is this a good thing?
Well, it's not a good thing for everybody else who wants to win the Tour de France someday. they'll have to put that off for another year at least, I suppose, because who can doubt, given what Lance Armstrong has done already with his life, who can doubt that he'll come back and do it again?
Right. And finally, we should take a moment, Bill, to mark the passing of Hall of Fame college basketball coach Don Haskins. He died on Sunday, and mm-hmm. he made history when he started five black players on his 1966 Texas Western team. Your thoughts, Bill?
Well, even the championship game, the NCAA championship game started five black players against the Kentucky team that had no black players. And the Haskins team, Texas team, won. It was a message to all coaches and athletic directors, and that was, if you want to win, you better be an equal opportunity recruiter.
All right. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which covers sports and a whole lot more. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Deb.
And coming up, why do whales sing? That's in a minute, here and now.
So, Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Well, autumn is approaching, which means that soon thousands of North Pacific humpback whales will begin their annual migration south from their summer feeding grounds off Alaska to breeding grounds in a government-protected marine sanctuary near the Hawaiian Islands. For years, Canadian scientist Jim Darling has traveled to Hawaii to try and figure out why those humpback whales sing to each other like that and what they're trying to say. From Hawaii, producer Heidi Chang has his story.
It's early on a sunny and warm Hawaiian morning. Zoologist Jim Darling is at the helm of his research boat as he takes off from Lahaina Harbor. He's on a personal quest.
We're going to go out and find some whales. Okay, here we go.
As Darling heads out to sea, the historic whaling town of Lahaina, Maui fades away in the distance. The town is a magnet for tourists during the peak of the whale mating season. Since 1997, these waters have been designated as the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. It's here the whales come to breed, calve, and nurse their young.
There's no question that this is a special place. This is one of the really special places in the world regarding whales.
The goal of the sanctuary is to help in the recovery of humpback whales that were once nearly hunted to extinction by the early 20th century. International laws now prohibit the hunting of humpbacks. And in the 1970s, the humpback whale was listed under the Endangered Species Act. Recent studies show the humpback population in Hawaii has been increasing annually by 7%.
Almost certainly the conditions in Hawaii, the warm waters, clear waters, shallow banks, are conditions which are beneficial to the reproductive success of these whales.
Jim Darling has been coming here from Vancouver, Canada. He's leading a study of humpback whale song for Whale Trust, a nonprofit research and education organization he co-founded on Maui. And there's plenty of action to observe. On this morning, it's not long before a huge whale breaches nearby. It's twice the size of the 20-foot-long research boat. Soon, Darling spots another whale in the distance and moves in closer to it. Darling quickly tosses a hydrophone, an underwater microphone, into the water and begins recording the whale's haunting song.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that the most unique thing about humpback whales is their song. Most other whales, I'd probably say virtually all other whales, make different types of sounds, and indeed some of them can be classified as songs. In other words, there's a series of sounds which are repeated, but none of them come close to the kind of loud, complex song of the humpback whales.
While some people may try to compare humpback songs with human songs, even going so far as describing them as arias, Darling says there is no equation.
Oh, I think they sound like a barnyard in the morning. it depends really. They sound incredibly beautiful, often from a distance, and often if you're in deep water where they're echoing off canyons and things like that. I mean, they're remarkably beautiful things to listen to. When you're really close, like we are, in other words, when you can actually see the singer below the boat, and the hydrophone is just, a few feet away from it, they're pretty loud and screechy. I mean, they're sort of hard to listen to.
These giant creatures first captivated Darling while he was growing up in Canada and began studying them in the 70s.
I used to, run charter boats and surf a lot on the west coast of Vancouver Island, and we'd see whales all the time and take people out to look at whales, and they'd start to ask questions. And when I went back to libraries and so on and tried to find answers just so I could sort of provide some information, I found we really knew very little about the animals.
Jim Darling is now one of the leading experts in whale song. While other researchers may study groups of whales from different regions and compare the differences and similarities in their song, Darling's approach is unique. He studies the day in the life of individual whales to better understand their behavior patterns and the function of song.
I think almost undoubtedly the prevailing hypothesis has been that males sing to attract females. There's unfortunately virtually no proof for that.
Darling was one of the first scientists to discover that only males sing, apparently as part of their mating strategy. And he became the first scientist to propose that the male song attracts other males.
I think it's quite clear now that the song is at least and perhaps primarily a signal between males, and it doesn't repel them. It in fact attracts them. Males sing until they interact with another male.
Jim Darling thinks singing is a signal of some kind between adult males, and it organizes them during the breeding season. He speculates song may determine their relationships as they compete or possibly cooperate with each other over access to females. He's still trying to figure out how it does it and why. On this journey, as Darling follows a singing whale, he's assisted by National Geographic whale photographer Flip Nicklin, who's on another research boat nearby.
Are you still with that singer?
Yeah, we're still loud with him.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just sort of slowly drift down that way and take a look at it. Thanks.
The boats stay in touch by two-way radio and keep track of what happens when a singing whale is joined by another whale. Each boat is prepared to follow a different whale once the whales split apart and head in different directions. A typical whale stays underwater about 10 to 15 minutes before surfacing to breathe, and its song can last anywhere from 5 to 25 minutes. But this particular singing whale turns out to be unpredictable. As it begins interacting with another whale, it becomes even more challenging to follow by boat. Both whales are moving fast, traveling together at about 5 miles an hour. As their shiny black dorsal fins roll in and out of the waves, they blow as they surface for air. In the end, Darling loses track of the initial singer as both whales go their separate ways. So calling it a day, he pulls into shore before sunset. Back on land, Darling listens to the day's recordings.
Okay, so what you heard here was the first theme, or often it's the first theme after the whale dives, and that woo-woo-woo-woo is really what we're calling the first theme. And then that shifts into the second theme, which is sort of a long, drawn-out screech.
Scientists don't know why the composition of whale song evolves from season to season. They found a song can change completely over 4 to 5 years. On this journey, Darling hears what he believes are some new sounds.
This is a bit of a new set here, and it may be something which is going to become more common over the next few years, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Do you have any idea what he's trying to communicate?
None at all.
Well, at least not yet. Jim Darling will spend the rest of the year analyzing his latest observations about humpback whale behavior and their hunt and songs.
Our profile of marine biologist Jim Darling was produced by Heidi Chang. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.